Science is as old as mankind. We observe nature, we try to understand its working, both to make our lives more pleasant and because we try to find our place in this universe, both for the sake of application, because we try to understand who we are, what we are made of, where we come from. The most important difference between human beings and other species is our ability to pass on knowledge over increasingly long distances in space and time. This has, during the evolution of mankind, allowed science to grow to an organized endeavor, managing an increasing body of knowledge. Today, science is a community enterprise, and it provides us with the insights that allow us to shape our future and drive progress. I went into science because I wanted to contribute part, only a small part, to that body of knowledge. But recently, I've become interested in the organization of that knowledge itself. So I want to start with a quotation by Asimov that I found fits very well. The saddest aspect of life right now is that gathers knowledge faster than society gathers wisdom. One wants to add how to deal with that knowledge that science has gathered, how to deal with it responsibly, efficiently, and to the benefit of all of us. Now, a lot of the changes that we are subject to are of the technological type. This always gives us the hope that technology will come up tools that allow us to better deal with that knowledge that science has gathered. But technology is a queer thing. It brings you great gifts with one hand and steps you the back with the other, quote C.P. Snow. Technologies are a priori neither good nor evil. They are tools that we have to learn how to use properly. And technologies can have drawbacks. So when I start talking about drawbacks, people often think I'm pessimistic. That's not the case, actually. I just always end up being the person talking about drawbacks because does it. But if we don't talk about the drawbacks, how can we learn how to improve using the tools that we have? So many people tell me change is always a good thing. And if it isn't, it is inevitable anyway. And since mankind survived the Cold War, we can be sure that we can deal with our problems that come along, and human ingenuity will eventually save the day. Self-organization will take place, and we will live happily ever after. That, of course, is nonsense. So let me address these three points. For one, the change that we are talking about here is not a biological change that we have to adapt to as a species. It is a change that we are creating ourselves. We don't have to adapt to it, but we can direct it. Change is not necessarily equal to progress. We have to regress. But it is, of course, true that humans are good with adapting conditions, also if they are for the worse. Then raises the question, well, if change is not for the better, how do we react appropriately? I don't believe in self-organization. I don't believe in self-organization because everybody believes in self-organization. Everybody does organization. So there is a typical problem with naturally occurring self-organizing mechanisms, that is, everything that relies on instant feedback typically does not take well into account facts that become important only on very long distance scales or long time scales. This is one of the reasons why we have a large problem to deal with global environmental problems. So these long-term goals that become important on global scales are not very well integrated by effects that rely on feedback, such as operational. So progress, of course, is a long-term goal. It needs to status, consider it feedback. Change needs conscious monitoring to achieve these long-term goals. So speaking of desk organization, while we were trying to arrange this meeting on century, they started to refer to this conference and the future of science. I find this very interesting because, as far as I'm concerned, we already live in this. And a lot of change has taken place. You can basically see and feel it happening. When I finished high school, I didn't have a computer, I didn't have internet. I used to spend my days in the library. The book I was looking for was always up on the shelf, the ladder was always in the wrong aisle, and I don't miss it. So I think a lot of the change that we have seen is certainly of the better kind. But one has to look into it and find out what are the aspects that we don't like and talk about them. So there are five general reasons for why the scientific community has seen a lot of change. These are these main points. For one is the communities are constantly growing. We have increasingly more knowledge that needs to be managed. We have an easier and faster access to information. The community is getting better connected on a global level, and it is also getting closer to the public. And in the following, I want to discuss some pros and cons. Be a bit provocative, hopefully stir up some discussion that we can have later, and I just want to put opinion on the table. So the first example is open access. So this is a large topic, and I don't want to talk about this in particular now. I just think we will have several talks on this issue. The general question here is whether in the long run, a high quality will be assured in the organization and management of scientific information. So let me then move on to the second example, which is Garrett, who is sitting in the back row, wrote a paper last year titled An Exceptionally Simple Theory of Everything that he uploaded on the archive sometime in November. The archive is an open access preprint server in physics that, well, at least some of you very well know. It was developed by Paul Ginsberg, who will be here tomorrow. So the actual content of that paper is also interesting in that. In that context, I just want to mention that it is a very theoretical paper with heavy mathematics. It does not really contain any new experiment or observational data. So it's not the type of paper that typically gets a lot of attention. As some of you might know, I'm writing a blog, and I happen to write a brief summary at the commentary on that paper. And that is the visitor statistic of my blog during this time. So you see here the weekly average in October was about 800-900. This commentary I published on November 6th or something. This first small peak is a link from Peter Voigt's blog, who said something about Garrett's paper in my blog. Then on November 14th, there was a article in the Telegraph commenting on the Shepherd-Hewitt physicist with the theory of everything. And 2 days later, or so, there followed in this article of Garrett's paper, which I was quoted with brief statements. None of these both articles actually linked to my blog, but thousands of people came Googling for Garrett and his paper. So on this, there followed dozens of similar articles, newspapers, blogs, and so on and so forth. I eventually had to close the insects when it reached about 300 commands. I received several journalist requests, was asked to appear on radio. The archive by now lists 22 trackbacks to that paper, which for a theoretical physics paper is probably a record. I also received a lot of emails from people who sent their theory of physics. I can only imagine what Garrett's inbox might have looked like. So I think this is a very interesting event and certainly surprising for a paper on theoretical physics. But I think that in other areas, people have pretty much gotten used to this sort of media. I think about arts or entertainment or parts of science that are closer to the public. So there are several things that we can learn from this. For one, we have an increasing public interest in science. And I don't know if that just includes the science in the public. This is to a certain extent regarded with suspicion by the community, especially if it is interest first. That is not so surprising because science lives from its objectivity. And, we should discuss the content of scientific work and not fall for personal cult. But on the other hand, I think that this was to get used to that kind of media that we get. This also can have a potential influence, so a direct influence. Actually, but direct influence, especially on younger people who follow what is reported on media. When I was a student, I certainly read this sort of thing to see what people think is interesting. But more generally, people typically overestimate their rationality. So there is an increasing amount of research about how people make decisions. But I just want to say that just reading about topic repeatedly raises this attention that otherwise would not get. And then there is a more subtle and indirect influence on the community through the belief that public interest can affect funding. So that might also be the case that it does indeed affect funding, right? But just the case that you think it might be can change something about what people would be interested by in that strategy. So, a skeptic. I am a particle physicist, and particle physicists like to smash things together, elementary particles, and then they examine the debris and try to understand the structure of elementary matter. So the goal and that kind of procedure is typically to get a lot of energy in a small range of space to create a large energy density. And in 2000, the BBC commented on experiments that were done at the CERN superprotons at this time as this being a little bang. And they explained fairly accurately. They created conditions that existed a thousandth of a second after the birth of the universe in a so-called Big Bang. So during the Big Bang, we think there was a very high energy density, and then the universe expanded and all that stuff out lower and lower energy density. And with these experiments, we can reproduce a state that dates back into the history of the universe, but it is still at far lower energy densities than what the Big Bang would have been. In 2002, CNN had upgraded this little bang to the little Big Bang. So this is a different collider, the relativistic heavy ion collider, but the difference in the energy density is not relevant. And in 2007, this state became the recreation of the Big Bang. And this I found is a very interesting storyline. So this is not a single case. The LHC, which is a big collider that is supposed to start running very soon, has repeatedly been referred to as the Big Bang machine, and newspapers talk about recreating the Big Bang in the lab, and so on and so forth. So this is not only a somewhat vague statement or a somewhat inaccurate statement, it is simply a completely wrong statement. So to just give you an impression, there are about 19 orders of magnitude different in the density between what we think the Big Bang was and what the LHC will produce in heavy ion conditions. So what can we learn from this? It's not really news, but it has to be said. Cheap advertisement for the sake of entertainment and popularity goes to the expense of accuracy. There are a lot of people, including some of my colleagues, who say, well, we should be grateful for any kind of advertisement that we get, but, well, otherwise nobody would be interested in it anyway. And there's certainly some truth in that, but I don't think we can go that far. One has to draw a line somewhere. So I certainly see that if one wants to communicate science to the public, one has to live with somewhat vague expressions and with a lack of details, but it should not become completely wrong and absolutely inaccurate, even if that might be boring to some extent. On the long run, this would get us maybe a higher entertainment value, but it will lead to an erosion of trust, in the accuracy of science, and the long-term prognosis of this is just disastrous because science lives from accuracy. So this then raises two questions. The one is how to improve the communication between scientists and journalists. But more generally, the question is, which feedback can there be that guarantees quality? So the underlying reason for that sort of infotainment is, of course, that it has to smell. That's what people write these stories. That's why the information becomes smaller and smaller. So a third and last example, also from particle physics. There are certain theories, these are speculations, which it might be possible that in particle colliders, the energy densities in a particle collision become so high that a black hole can be created. And it has been discussed repeatedly in the media whether this could have the result that these black holes grow and swallow the Earth, and this would be the end of mankind. So I don't want to discuss the details of this here, but just to give you the brief answer to this question, we do not have any self-consistent theory in which it could be possible that these black holes are dangerous. Nevertheless, the story has hit the media already in 1999 when Rick was about to start. So they turned off the world. Now we are waiting for the LHC to start, and this story has come back. So these are some examples of what you can find. Will black holes follow the Earth? This is an article from the New York Times that comments on a lawsuit that was filed against CERN, where this experiment is supposed to start. This was actually a very good article. The problem was that you could read it, but it was difficult. Large Hadron Collider could spell doomsday for the Earth. Big Bang machine could destroy the planet, and so on and so forth. This is an example from a German magazine that says, will a black hole swallow the Earth? And here you see how the surrounding cities will be sucked into this, because one doesn't have to look far on the internet to find entertainment for this. So this is the animated version of this, where the black hole starts sucking in the world. One should add that matter that gets accreted onto a black hole gets heated up to very high temperatures, which leads to emission of a lot of radiation that you see here. The diameter of a black hole with the mass of the Earth is about 3. So, This is an interesting story because the situation in the community in this case has actually been very clear, despite what people said. There has not been really any discussion about it. But, okay, so this is like, somebody's always there outside. But the situation has been really very clear. And I think this upset people, my colleagues. And I was certainly not the only one who wrote angry letters to editors. I also wrote my blog about this. And the situation indeed clarified at some point. So this is a science article that says it's not a threat to the Earth. CERN, where this experiment takes place, has been very slow with answering to the concerns that has been raised. They had a safety report in 2003 that did address all of these points that had been raised. And it has only been in June that Steve Giddings from the University of Santa Barbara, Michelangelo Pagano from CERN, wrote a very long paper that updates the safety report. This then was picked up by the media. If the Large Hadron Collider produced a black hole, it probably wouldn't matter. The Excimelon odds against the destruction of the Earth, Earth not at risk from collider, and eventually court rejects the test against Big Bang because this was a loss by Europe. So it remains to be said the LHC will have first collision on Wednesday, and I will be really pissed off at the world. So, of course, in this case, again, we have this lack of accuracy in the reporting. But there is another point here that I want to emphasize that I find very interesting, and that is that the public was very eager getting this information. I received a lot of emails who were saying, well, look, I'm really concerned. Can you tell me what is going on? I received emails dealt with Barry, the housewife from Iowa, who wanted to know what is the deal with this machine that could destroy the Earth. I had a friend who got an email from a teenage girl who asked him, well, why do you destroy the world? I received letters telling me I'm a bad person. And, well, I don't like that. But at some point, I had to tell myself, well, is this really my stuff? I would have thought that would be earlier, but they were really slow with that. And it adds to this that I'm not actually working on this topic. And also, you know, these questions that you get, they are pretty basically always the point I started just big block. But this raises a very general point, that's the question, where do we take the for this, who task is it to deal with things like this? If the public is asking for that information, they don't trust very well sector of these various institutions. So in this case, it happened that I knew a lot of the details that were these questions that they were concerned about this issue. But I can kind of understand that people were about the gift that the media published this scary story. People were looking for points. So at some point I said, well, look, I just don't have the time to deal with this. I'm a researcher. And writing a blog is very interesting in many regards. So whenever I say something that people don't like, I get comment, my taxes pay you. Yeah, it's, well, in every case when that happened, it actually was not the case that this person's taxes had something to do with my salary. But the general idea that is behind that is, well, I'm a scientist and my work has to be beneficial for the public. And I agree with that, but my day has only 24 hours. Another case when I got this comment was when I mentioned, well, I'm not contributing to Wikipedia and everything. And I have no intention to do so. That's for various reasons. For one, because I don't believe in the merits of collective knowledge. The other thing is that I learned in high school to understand a text, it is necessary to know the social, cultural, and educational background of the author, and I believe that to be right. But besides this, I did not go into science while an encyclopedia. And it would take me a lot of time to do that. I certainly see that it is beneficial to have Wikipedia there, and it's very useful in many regards, but whose task is it to do that? And for these people who do that, and I appreciate very much, is that effort presently sufficiently acknowledged? So, you see, I'm raising a lot of questions here, and but I always have solutions to everything. So just let me give you a proposed solution to that. There would be a just specific division of labor where scientists can specialize into certain careers in a way that one has a suitable appreciation that can be put in the CV, and most importantly, that one acknowledges that management of scientific knowledge is necessary and it is a needed skill. So some pros and cons on this, just to sum this up, among the pros, there's certainly a larger public interest in research that can potentially lead to a better science literacy. So that's a good thing. It also lowers barriers to education on a global level, and it also embraces outsider knowledge, gets close to the public. And we'll have a talk about some aspects of this Wednesday at 10 by Eric Collins, who will talk about how electronic media blur the boundary between acquiring specialist knowledge by expert community and to reading. On the negative side, we have the lacking accuracy and a lot of loss of trust that can result in the long run. We have a public pressure on research directions and an increased time pressure on the researchers because somebody has to deal with that. And the belief that scientists are with this next slide. The cost in all cases of the negative side is a mismanagement of information and knowledge. And we'll have a discussion about this this evening, moderated by Keith. So let me come to this point about sheep. In many cases, when magazines or newspapers report on scientific topics, they do not very well mention the sources that they have. They do not add references or links to further reading. There are notable exceptions to this, but this is generally the case. And this communication of science as being very easy and not having very much content has the drawback that it supports the belief that education is kind of unnecessary and the PhD is a hoax. Basically because people don't know what we actually learn in education. You add to this the easy and fast reachability of scientists, also the well-known scientists, and you get a lot of people who will go to websites or institutes and pick a name that they have heard of, and just send them an email with a question or with their theory or whatever. And I guess that many of us have made this experience. So this has some results. For one, it is necessary at some point to filter this information that comes in. I think of myself as a very average person, so I just tell you how I filter this information. I guess people do something very similar. If I don't know the name of the sender and the sender address is obscure and the person establish any relation to me, my work, or relative to the person who dies, then it is very likely that I will ignore the email and it will wander down in my inbox. So the typical scenario is that people require to request their own level or above, and there are some obvious dangers in that necessary filtering of information because we cannot deal with all that information that we receive. That is, we might be missing useful information. So these criteria are, of course, not the best criteria that you can have. It reinforces a closed academic society, and what is possibly even worse, the academic community itself gets leveled by importance. The reason for this is basically that nowadays everybody connects with everybody all over the world. If you can do that, why don't you just speak to the important people instead of the ones that sit next door? So again, the course of this is mismanagement of information, knowledge. Possible ways to do that better would be, of course, a better communication of scientific methods to begin with, but also to offer a place where people can address their questions and where they can send their ideas to. So one of the problems with that stuff that I get sent, that it's on a level, if you send it to some journal, it would get rejected before even entering the peer review. So these people then start feeling like the unrecognized genius that is dismissed by the academic society, when what they would actually need would be some good hints how to improve the quality of their work. The general question that lurks behind this is whether scientists embrace openness at all. So this is openness to the public as well as inside the community, and Michael will tell us some more about this tomorrow afternoon. So the message that we get from this is that science, information, and knowledge needs management. So far, I have mostly talked about the connection of the scientific community to the public. So this is the external part. Before I come to the internal part, I want to tell you some general changes in our society. So one is what I like to call the illusion of knowledge, going back to the great obstacle in discovering the shape of the earth, the continents, and the oceans was not ignorance, but the illusion of knowledge. So this illusion is greatly supported by the internet for various reasons. The most obvious one is sheer availability. Information is cheap and everybody can know everything. And I paraphrase know because information does not equal knowledge. There's also the belief that relevant information which is online can be found easily. And well, the problem with that is that unordered information is basically no information. So we have this vast amount of information and we need to filter it somehow. And search tools are very important for this issue. And one has to be a bit a bit cautious about this, because this filtering of information can potentially also have some impact on how we make decisions, even political decisions. So I find it kind of funny how much importance shifts to search engines. But this is a point that I don't want to discuss in further detail here. There is the general problem with infotainment that I mentioned earlier, that science is cheap, and the belief that learning must be easy. If a topic is complicated, that must be the fault of the person explaining it. Then there is the belief that if it's not on the internet, it doesn't exist. The problem here is actually a larger one. So one would think that the longer the internet is out there, the more information makes it on the internet. But information that people typically upload on the internet is what they think will be interesting for other people. So that makes you wonder what happens to the stuff that nobody currently finds interesting. Will that ever make it on the internet if there is no plan behind that? And then there's also the point that online one can find support for whatever point of view one holds. And one can very nicely ignore all the other points of view that other people hold. Again, the cause for this is a mismanagement of information and knowledge. So another very general effect that we have in our well-connected society is information overload, characterized as difficulties in locating, retrieving, processing, storing, and or re-retrieving information. So that is the kind of effect that you have if you were looking for this link and it's not in the browser history and you didn't set a bookmark and my God, what was the keyword that you used to bring it up and now you can't find it again. So that causes stress, at least me. And it's, well, yeah, so there are some serious concerns behind that because, well, the human brain was not made to manage with all that information. And again, it has to be filtered somehow. And people are, if they have to, they will come up with all kinds of cheap and immediate filters. The one with the emails that I said is one. But another trend that you can see is that people start skimming the sites. They will only read like the title and the last line. This is also something that I notice on my blog. And this is also a cause of information overload. There is, at least on some aspects of this, a growing amount of research behind that, especially when it comes to the decline in productivity through work interruptions and trouble concentrating. That's not so surprising that there is some research going into this direction because it lowers profit of companies. So this is a reason for the industry to act. And in fact, there was recently funded a research group on that, so I don't want to advertise this website. I actually didn't look at it too closely. I just found it interesting and wanted to mention it. If you look at the member directory, you'll find various people from different universities as well as from major companies such as Google, IBM, Microsoft, and so on. So they have certainly noticed that there is a problem with that that one needs to address, and there's certainly the hope that improvement in technological tools will help us to deal with that situation better. But at least so far, I have the impression that the trend is more that everything seems to get more complicated and has more application and so on and so forth. So I would certainly welcome a trend towards simplification and minimalism. But this also raises the question, well, what about academia? So that was about the industry. How long will it take until we notice that we have to think about these matters as well? And information overload is also a problem on a larger issue. So this is a quotation from Homer Dixon's book, The Ingenuity Gap, who comments on the problem of information overload when it comes to decision making in our democracy. So he says, it is understandable where this breathless infotainment style comes from if one considers that we live in this environment of information overload. But it is this infotainment caused by this is completely inappropriate in an increasingly complex world that demands increasingly sophisticated policymaking. And I completely agree with him on that. And we will have a talk about science in political decision making by Beth Novak on Thursday morning, and we will have later a design exercise on that political decision making that I'm very much looking forward to. So now I want to zoom on a bit again on scientific research. So this are results of a recent study by the University College in London about the information behavior of the researcher of the future. And they summarize that research behavior that they found is an impatient in search and navigation and zero tolerance for any delay in satisfying information needs. And these are now the norm for all age groups, from younger pupils and undergraduate through to professors. And they call for two kinds of actions. So the one is that they call for libraries to respond urgently to the changing needs of the researchers. So this is certainly an instant feedback. But they also address the long-term problem, and they point out that young people are dangerously lacking information skills. So this is a study from the UK. This is just an example. There are various studies going in this direction and from various countries. What they mean here with information skills is not that these objects of that study didn't know how to use Google, but that they didn't know what to do with the results that they found, how to accurately judge on the sources of the information that they found, and things like this. So to zoom somewhat even more closer onto the scientific community, there was recently a paper in Science about citation behavior, and I don't want to discuss that in too much detail. I just want to mention two points that this paper brought up that I think are well made. The one is that online journals generally require less browsing and allow a very targeted search that lowers accidental broadness and diversification of interest. That's the kind of effect that you have if you open a volume at the wrong page and you have to flip through five different papers, and then you think, well, wow, this is interesting. Why didn't I think of this before? So this is something that just does not happen anymore. The study also shows that references tended to be more recent. Fewer journals and articles were cited, and more of those citations were to fewer journals and articles. So I'm not really sure how concerned one has to be about this, but I wanted to mention it nevertheless. The reason why I'm not sure about this is that you'd think part of this behavior is because nowadays you can very easily search for a keyword online. So the need to really cite all related articles is less today.
Article, and yeah, many results are contradicting this.
Yeah, so I noticed that, but I wanted to mention it anyway. It also actually does not agree with my personal experience, because I have the impression that citation lists are getting longer and longer and longer, and certainly not shorter. Okay, so here are some pros and cons of better connectivities. It is easier to find collaborators who share their own interests, and social networking makes it easier to find relevant information, which can save a lot of time. But the negative aspect of this is that it supports specialization. If you can find somebody who shares your interests very precisely and you can work together with this person, you don't have to talk to the person who is sitting in your office. Another problem is that networking can become so useful that social skills dominate scientific skills. This is a point that I will come back to later. And this is certainly a waste of time, because time you spend on social networking is not time you spend on research. So again, these negative points that I have here are caused by a mismanagement, in this case, a mismanagement of science. So again, we see that science, information, and knowledge meets management. And I now want to shift gears a bit. So far, I have told you about the influence of technological change on the scientific community. Now, I want to broaden this up somewhat to these five factors that I mentioned in the beginning are changing the scientific community. Larger communities, increasingly more knowledge, easy access to information, better connectivity, and getting closer to the public. So behind the question of pros and cons, there's always the question of judgment. The question, what is good and what isn't for progress on the long run. And in the following, I want to offer you a simple approach on how to judge on that change. So science, we have learned, works. And it works no matter what method we use, because eventually nature will come and judge on our ideas. And the useful ideas will get selected, and the other ones will sort it out, and we can move on. That's the story. But this is only half of the story. The other part of the story is that it is, in practice, very often necessary to judge on ideas when they are still very young, and this judgment is done by the peers in our community. Whether this is for a grant application or for a job application, in many instances it is necessary, necessary to judge on the promise of an idea when it is still young and immature, and it depends on the judgment of the scientific community whether these ideas can grow up, fully develop, and eventually actually come to the point where they can be judged by on nature. So the scientific community is very important in this stage when ideas have to grow up. And this process is very susceptible to external pressure. And what is essential for it to work properly are objectivity, honesty, and open criticism within the scientific community. So the Ivory Tower has now achieved a status where it is quite cynically referred to as the idea of the academic who is detached from the real world and who doesn't know what is going on. But there was a reason for this ivory tower and for this detachment, that was to protect science from any influence. And this protection is now slowly crumbling away, and we are subject to many pressures that very really affect the scientific discourse and affect the topics that we find interesting and the research direction that we choose. So there are four different kinds of pressure, some of which I already mentioned. There is the public pressure. Well, scientists are human, so we like if our work is appreciated by the public, but this can also have a drawback if we pay too much attention to this, that one has to be aware of. Also, public pressure can have an impact on the financial pressure in that it affects where interests go and where funding go. But financial pressure also has different aspects, that is, where you need to write grant application, you have to get the money in, you need to find a job. And since jobs in academia are typically tied to certain topics, this affects where people go, depending on where the jobs are. So the question on where the money goes is an interesting question, actually. It is kind of easy to put the blame on funding agencies, but this is not quite accurate, because funding agencies typically rely on experts' advice, and they do so for a good reason. So eventually, it seems that it comes back to the judgment of our peers on us. And if you're working in a community with a large competition or pressure, this is certainly an important factor, because you would think twice before you disagree with the well-known people in the field, because it can potentially affect your career options. And then there's the time pressure, which has two aspects. The one aspect is that jobs in academia tend to become shorter and shorter termed, which has the effect that people try to work on topics that fit into this time frame and do not have the opportunity to really work on the ambitious long-term projects. The other aspect of the time pressure is that what I mentioned earlier is that the changes in our community put additional demands on the scientists, and the question is, who deals with this? Where do we take the time? So the present academic system favors, because of this, several behavior and disfavors others. So what it favors is specialization. The trend to specialization is actually a very common trend. One can also observe this in economical and ecological systems. The reason why it is a favorable behavior is that if you specialize into a niche and you make yourself the world expert, then you have no competition. And this is something that people also do within the scientific community. You put yourself onto your own research topic, and then you have a name for this, and this is what you're working on. And this works quite well. Another trend that this favors is the use of shortcuts. With that, I mean easy measures and meter scientific instruments. Meter scientific instruments, as for example, a citation index, and reliance on other people's judgments. You know, that sort of question that says, well, do you know that person? What do you think about him? So Steve Fuller will tell us on Wednesday at 11 something about the influence of meter scientific instruments such as the citation index and Wikipedia, something like this, on academic research and how we deal with this. So he will join us per video, and I hope very much that this will work out. So the use of these shortcuts is only an example of this latter point, that generally the system favors the fulfillment of secondary criteria as opposed to primary goals. So what I mean with that, the primary goal in this case would, for example, be doing good science. But this is rather vague, and what people use instead are derived secondary criteria where they look at specific measures such as the number of papers, citations, how many famous co-authors does that person have, and another criteria that comes in here is that the projects are appropriately timed, so you finish them in time and you write a report when it's due. And so on and so forth. This also favors advertisement because marketing is useful to help you with that. On the other hand, it disfavors interdisciplinarity, that's like the opposite of specialization. It disfavors interdisciplinarity because it is really hard to change topic, because you only get a grant or a job if you have a prior record of work in that field. So it is very difficult to change field. And that's kind of a problem, because it is well known that very many breakthroughs come from the intersection of different fields, from people who manage to combine different areas. So this is an effect that has been well known for a long time. And in fact, funding agencies fund a lot of interdisciplinary research, but there is still this problem in the community that it is not really encouraged on the personal level. This also disfavors working on long-term and risky projects, and Eric Weinstein will tell us something about this on Tuesday, and generally anything that can be put in the CV. The result of this is a mismanagement of academia, an inefficient use of time, human and financial resources, and sociological effects that result in bubbles of nothing that will eventually burst. The reason for this is that we have a positive feedback effect in which people go where money goes and money go where people goes. And the reason for this is that we have a community of experts that basically judges on itself. So bubbles of nothing that eventually burst is my expression. David Kaiser calls that booms and busts, and he will tell us something about this in the history of science on Wednesday at 2. So if you think that was depressing, of course I have a solution to the problem. Generally the solution is everything that lowers these four pressures, and here are some examples of this. I will not go through them by point by point, because I'm running out of time, but some of these things I actually realized right here at Perimeter Institute, such as not to tie researchers two specific topics or supervisors, but to let them freely choose their interact. And there is certainly at this place a lot of effort in interdisciplinary work, which also made it possible to actually have this conference, which is certainly not the kind of topic I usually work on. So we will have a discussion on these topics on Wednesday evening. So, yeah, these are not new insights. I just want to give you some quotation about what other people have said about this. This is a quotation by Feynman, who comments on the interaction with the public. You should not fool the layman, he says. When you're talking as a scientist, then he tells you something about cheating on your wife. And then he goes on, integrity it's our responsibility as scientists, certainly to other scientists, and I think to the layman. And he also adds down here that he wishes you may have the freedom for this integrity, and that you do not feel forced by a need to maintain your position in the organization of financial support. So he comments on this pressure that I was talking about. This is Freeman Dyson, more than a decade ago, who comments on fashionable fields that have been moving further and further into specialized areas. And he complains that rule by committee discourages unfashionable and bold ventures. Then we have Lee Smolin, who wrote a book, The Trouble with Physics, that was published 2 years ago. And he comments on measures of status that are given by numerical ranking. So these are the shortcuts that I referred to earlier. Department chairs and deans have to be concerned with this because such matters have brought financial repercussions relevant for their own careers as administrator. The goal is then not to hire the scientist most likely to do good science, but the scientist whose acquisition will optimize the status of the department in the short term. So we see very clearly that we have kind of lost out of sight the long-term goals, and he refers to the problem that secondary criteria have become more important than the primary goals. Lee will give a talk on Wednesday, though not really about this, I think. So these were all physicists, but this is not a problem that is constrained to physics only. So in some areas, this seems not to be such a large problem. For example, I hear that mathematics is actually fairly healthy in this regard. I believe the reason for this is that the competitive pressure in this field is not so very high, and it is also very detached from the public due to the abstractness of this research. But this is a biologist, and some other people have told me that that there are many kids in biology who have similar problems. I would be very interested to talk about this more. And Peter Lawrence comments on writing grant application, in which he says honesty is little valued. And I'm not sure how well time or science is served by this rather weird process. Neither am I. And then this leaves one to wonder why, if the problem is so well known and has been so well known for various decades, why then hasn't anybody done something about it? And there are various reasons that I can imagine for this, and I will just speculate a bit about this. The one that is maybe the most obvious one is survivor bias. People who survive in this field are typically the ones who do well within the system, and then they have little reason trying to change this. There's also what I previously mentioned, the belief in self-organization. So the system is just what the system is, and if it wasn't good, self-organization would take place and this problem would be solved. So this is just the system. This is a comment that I hear fairly often. But there's also the point that we are part of the society we live in, and this belief that direction by financial incentives and instant feedback has a good effect on the long run is certainly widespread in Western societies, and I think this reflects to some extent in the scientific community. There's also the problem of habit and inertia. So you just get used to working in a certain environment, and then you accept it and don't think about it. And Andrew will tell us tomorrow a bit about the power of inertia. And Barry Wellman on Tuesday will talk a bit more about the general changes that our society have seen, some of which I believe reflect in our community. But the point that I probably think is the most relevant one is that the system very nicely disables its own improvement because people are busy with focusing on improving their career. So this is also something that I asked myself when I organized this conference. So what is it good for? So we will have a discussion of some of these topics on Tuesday evening. So this is the discussion that will take place over here. Again, science information and knowledge needs management. So now I am slowly running out of time. Let me see. Yeah, we have seen that, roughly speaking, we have two areas here, the internal and external organization of science. I like to think of all these topics that we are discussing here as lying in this information triangle that roughly depicts that the interaction between the society and science has gotten an additional dimension, that is information technology. And it is not so surprising that most of the talks at this meeting lie somewhere on the interaction between science and information technology. We will have several talks about this in the following days. And we will have a discussion about this on Tuesday evening. Another aspect about science and IT is scientometrics, the analyzation of data from our community that allows us to say something about our community's collaboration structures and the dynamics. This is another meta-scientific tool that is interesting both to learn and to potentially manage the scientific community. And I put these dots here because to caution again, because of the potential problem that we can run in with meta scientific tools. Katie Berner will talk about this tomorrow afternoon. And she meant to bring some poster exhibition, though I'm not sure whether this actually worked out. So if it arrives, it should be downstairs in the lobby. And Alex will tell us this evening about a very different kind of maps, a roadmap of the future of science. Then there are also the topics that are not covered. There are always topics that are not covered that I just want to briefly mention. That is the resilience of data storage, science education, information overload, and the future of democracy. With that, I mean the influence that developments in information technology can have on the decision making in our political systems. So, research in science education tell me that the number of new information items that people can recall from a 1 hour talk is about 7. And I'm afraid I might have used them up. So instead of adding more details, I just want to give you the big picture. Here it comes, watch out. This is the big picture. So I started with this quotation, the saddest aspect of life right now is that science gathers wisdom faster than society gathers knowledge. And this management of the knowledge that science has gathered is a problem far beyond our own community. And I think that the global scientific community is necessary to solve the problems that mankind is facing now and in the future. Our input is desperately needed in policy making as well as for studies that are being done more and more often, in which the question is how a political decision will influence what happens after this. So this is a question that clearly lies on the scientific side and not on the side of scientific of decision making. And our input is needed in this process because we just don't have the time anymore. We don't have the wiggle room to proceed further by trial and error. I have lost faith in politics to deal with these problems. And so I think have many other people. And I think a good way to reestablish this trust is to bring some scientific method in there. But before we can do this, we first have to ensure the functionality of our own community and that we manage to organize our own knowledge. So why this conference? Because for me, science is more than a profession, it is a worldview. We need science to move on, and science needs us. Science, information and knowledge needs management, and this is why you are all here, because you have worked on and are interested in various aspects of this problem. It is a topic that lies at the intersection of the natural sciences, the social sciences, and the computer sciences, and it is a topic that will become increasingly important. Thank you for your attention.